Hello and welcome back to the Fall of the Roman Empire. My name is Nick Holmes and this is episode 7 called The Secret of the Empire. In the last episode, we heard about the reign of Commodus, who was one of the maddest of all the Roman emperors, as portrayed so well in the film Gladiator. Now, many people think of Commodus's reign as marking the beginning of the fall of the Roman Empire, and there's certainly some truth in this, since his father Marcus Aurelius's reign was both a high watermark in terms of the Roman Empire's size and prosperity, but also witnessed the first major challenges that the empire would face in the form of a serious Germanic attack by the Quadi and Marcomanni, as well as a devastating plague, indeed the first pandemic to hit humanity, called the Antonine Plague. Now, we'll deal with both of these in later episodes, because in this episode, I'd like to focus on a subject that had always been a big problem for the Romans since the last days of the Republic and would become, I think, the major cause of Rome's decline in the 3rd century. And this problem was civil war. Now, the real problem was that Augustus had left a state where power was fought over between three main factions: the Senate, the Emperor, who was supposedly chosen by the Senate, and the army, which could, of course, proclaim whoever it wanted as Emperor because it had the military power. So what we'll do in this episode is to examine how the Roman political system started to go wrong, really from the death of Marcus Aurelius in 180 AD, when he was succeeded by his son Commodus. And we'll start with an extraordinary incident after Commodus was murdered, when the Praetorian Guard tried to auction the empire to the highest bidder. So I'll read from my own research and writing this time. Hope you enjoy it. The day was the 28th of March, 193 AD. The Praetorian Guardsmen marched in silence up the Palatine Hill. Their red-plumed helmets reminded onlookers of their arrogance. Some Romans even spat at them before running away. The gates to the imperial palace swung open. They too were manned by Praetorians. They entered a huge colonnaded courtyard. There before them was the man they wanted. The Roman Emperor Pertinax eyed them with a doleful grimace. He was 66 years old. Like the Praetorians, he too had been a soldier, born the son of a freed slave. He had joined the army and won many honours in campaigns against the Persians and Dacians. Promoted to senator, he had governed Syria, Moesia, Dacia, Africa and Britain. His courage had always been beyond doubt, his integrity beyond reproach. Only 86 days previously, the Senate had elected him emperor after the murder of the hated tyrant Commodus. But the Senate had forgotten one thing: the corrupt and malleable Praetorian Guard. Now Pertinax faced the Praetorians. One of them marched up to him. Pertinax told him to halt. He reminded him of his oath of loyalty so recently taken. But the Praetorian ignored him. He walked up to him, drew his sword, and drove it into the emperor's heart. As Pertinax collapsed to the ground, the other Praetorians swarmed around him, hacked off his head, and carried it back to their camp on a spear. Then followed one of the most extraordinary events in the whole of human history. The Praetorians decided to auction the Roman Empire to the highest bidder. A suitable candidate came forward. His name was Didius Iulianus. He was a senator and a man of prodigious wealth who agreed to pay 25,000 sesterces to every Praetorian. This was perhaps equivalent to 10 years' pay for an ordinary soldier. Iulianus only lasted 9 weeks before he too was beheaded by the Praetorians. But with Iulianus, their motive was fear, not greed. For outside Rome were the legions from the Danube. These veterans hated the corrupt Praetorians in disgust at the murder of Pertinax. They had marched on Rome. At their head was a general called Septimius Severus. The Praetorians knew they were finished. They surrendered to Septimius, who spared their lives but disbanded and exiled them far away from Rome. He then replaced them with a new Praetorian guard drawn from his loyal Danubian soldiers. Thereafter, the Praetorians gradually faded in importance until they were finally abolished by the Emperor Constantine in 312 AD. Edward Gibbon said that the decline of the Roman Empire began when the Praetorians put it up for auction. In a sense, he was right, for it marked the most outrageous usurpation of power that had yet taken place. But the truth was that it merely highlighted the fundamental weakness of the Roman political system. This was what Tacitus had described over 100 years before as the secret of the empire. This secret was, as Tacitus put, that emperors could be made elsewhere than at Rome itself. When he said this, Tacitus was describing the year of the four emperors in 68-9 AD, when immediately after Nero's suicide, four different emperors, Galba, Otto, Vitellius and Vespasian, fought each other for control of the empire. It was the first civil war since Augustus had seized power, and it marked a return to the horrific internecine warfare that had destroyed the late Republic. Tacitus lamented the atrocities that year, quote, "I am entering on the history of a period rich in disasters, frightful in its wars, torn by civil strife, and even in peace full of horrors," end quote. But he could just as easily have been describing what was to happen in the 3rd century. For Rome's propensity for civil war was just as great, if not greater, in the 3rd century than it had been in the year of the four emperors as described by Tacitus. Indeed, in my opinion, it was to become the Roman Empire's Achilles heel and nearly to destroy it. The origins of this lie with the fact that Augustus's principate had no clear constitution. The Senate was theoretically the supreme political power, but everybody knew that in the last resort it was the army that had the force necessary to decide who was emperor. The Praetorians were an example of this. Despite only being a small part of the Roman Empire, they happened to be in the right place and at the right time. For being located in their camp on the outskirts of Rome and with the job of guarding the emperor, they were ideally placed to make and break emperors. Originally created by Augustus as his bodyguard, their importance as kingmakers developed because of the sheer size of the growing Roman Empire and the fact that the real army, the legions, were stationed hundreds if not thousands of miles away from Rome, guarding the frontiers with a long distance to travel if they wanted to create their own emperors in Rome. As highlighted in the Year of the Four Emperors, the crucial moment occurred at the time of succession. This was because Augustus did not make succession hereditary, since that would clearly have been monarchical, which he wanted to avoid. As with everything in Augustus's sham republic, the theoretical idea was that the Senate would approve his successor, but the reality was that he would make that choice for them. The fact that Augustus did not have any legitimate male children helped, for there was no question of hereditary succession. Instead, Augustus chose an adopted son, Tiberius, to succeed him, which was rubber-stamped by the Senate and accepted by the army and Praetorians. This imperial nomination worked again when Tiberius produced no heir. Like Augustus, Tiberius chose an adopted son to succeed him, but he made a very bad selection, for his adopted son was Caligula. At this point, the Augustan system met its first failure. Caligula broke the unwritten rules and turned against the Senate, putting several senators to death, and apparently even making his horse consul, among many other outrages. This prompted the Praetorian Guard, who had hitherto played no real part in politics, politics, to assassinate him with good cause, and to select Caligula's uncle Claudius as the next emperor on the basis that he was at least related to Augustus. This was the first watershed moment for the Augustan constitution. When confronted by the Praetorian selection, for a moment, the Senate apparently considered whether to try to restore the real republic. But the opportunity, if it ever really existed, was lost. Despite the fact that the Praetorians had used force, Claudius's reign was in fact a surprising success in that he restored the Augustan pretense of republic. Despite his physical afflictions, Suetonius, the Roman chronicler, described him as a slobbering and stammering weakling, which was possibly due to his having contracted polio as a child. He was, in fact, a remarkably intelligent and subtle emperor. He won over the Senate by showing it great respect. To stamp his authority on the army, he invaded Britain. Augustus, to whom he was distantly related, would have been proud of him. But Augustus would not have been proud of his successor, Nero, who, like Caligula, was described by Suetonius and Tacitus as a monster. Having alienated everybody that mattered, including the Senate, the Praetorian Guard, and the army, Nero chose to commit suicide rather than being lynched. It was at this moment that Tacitus's secret of the empire was discovered, for with Nero's suicide and no heir apparent, chosen by him or anyone else, 68 to 69 AD became the year of the four emperors, when the legions nominated four different emperors, the four main troop concentrations, i.e. those on the Rhine, the Danube, and in the east, as well as the Praetorian Guard in Rome, each chose different emperors. Vespasian, nominated by the Army of the East, eventually won the contest and ruled for 12 years, from 69 to 81 AD. One advantage of Vespasian's new Flavian dynasty, as it was called, was that for the first time, hereditary succession was accepted by the Senate. Vespasian was succeeded by his son, Titus, and then Titus was succeeded by his younger brother, Domitian. This acceptance of hereditary succession avoided a repeat of the Year of the Four Emperors, but the empire's underlying problem, the so-called secret of the empire, still lay unresolved, for even though hereditary succession had been established by the Flavians, the Senate and the army still considered themselves both the supreme kingmakers. Despite this, the flawed Augustan constitution continued very successfully, although Domitian's reign went badly because he fell out with the Senate and became so paranoid about assassination that his closest associates, even including his own wife, decided that they had to assassinate him to save their own lives. For the next 84 years, from Domitian's death in 96 AD to the death of Marcus Aurelius in 180 AD, there was a remarkably stable period of government, uninterrupted by anything other than the occasional minor rebellion. But it has to be concluded that this was due more to luck than to judgment, for there just happened to arise a succession of quite unusually gifted and dedicated emperors. These were the so-called five good emperors who ruled from 96 to 180 AD. They included Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, and Marcus Aurelius. Gibbon called this period of the Roman Empire the happiest age. And he was right that during it, the empire achieved its maximum size, together with probably its maximum population and economic prosperity. So why were the five good emperors so good? A key reason was that all five of them maintained Augustus's careful balance of power. They treated the Senate with respect, for example, promising not to condemn any senator to death. All five secured the backing of the majority of the legions, and all five were able to cow the Praetorian Guard into obedience. Trajan was helped by the fact that he was the finest military commander to lead the empire since Julius Caesar. He defeated the Dacians in a series of wars and occupied Dacia, creating a valuable buffer territory north of the Danube. He also routed the Parthians, capturing the Parthian capital Ctesiphon and extending Roman rule briefly over Mesopotamia. Trajan nominated his young relative Hadrian to succeed him, who proved to be one of the most enigmatic Roman emperors and whose real interests probably lay more with artistic and intellectual matters than with government, although he was disliked by the Senate, who regarded him as vain and dictatorial. He made his reign into a reasonable success by avoiding Rome itself and spending most of his time travelling, inspecting the frontiers, where, amongst other initiatives, he commissioned the famous Hadrian's Wall in Britain. Hadrian nominated a senator to succeed him, Antoninus Pius, who was in turn succeeded by probably the most widely admired of all the Roman emperors, Marcus Aurelius. The Antonines, as these two emperors were called, represented the apogee of the Augustan legacy, with both men dedicating themselves to the public good. Marcus Aurelius was a keen follower of Plato's philosophy and strongly believed in a stoical approach to life, as recorded so well in his famous Meditations, which has even become popular today as a self-help book. But was it just good luck in having a succession of capable emperors that enabled the Roman Empire to survive so successfully while it had such an incoherent political system? In fact, more than that was required. Rome also got lucky during the period of the Pax Romana with its external enemies. For until the 3rd century, it had no serious rivals, no serious invasions of its territories, just as Rome had been lucky in the 2nd and 1st centuries BC, when the power of the Greek successor states faded, allowing it to seize control of the whole of the eastern Mediterranean. So, in the years of the Principate, the absence of any truly powerful external enemies allowed Rome's flawed political system to continue. But in the 3rd century, things were different. Indeed, there were signs of bigger problems on the horizon already towards the end of the 2nd century, for in Marcus Aurelius's reign, there was the combination of the first serious Germanic invasion by the Quadi and Mecomani, the first major one since the Cimbri and Teutones had threatened Italy 300 years previously and were defeated by Marius, as we discussed in a previous episode, together with the outbreak of the first pandemic in human history, the Antonine Plague. If that wasn't bad enough, Marcus Aurelius also couldn't stop his son Commodus from becoming emperor. What resulted was a shambolic 12 years of incompetent rule in which Commodus alienated the Senate, spent most of his time showing off his supposed gladiatorial skills in the Colosseum, in fights carefully scripted so that his adversaries didn't hurt him and he in return would spare their lives. One night, when he was preparing his gladiator costume ready to perform the next day, his favourite mistress, who feared for her own life at the hands of this unpredictable lunatic, persuaded his wrestling companion to strangle him. Then things started to really fall apart. Following Commodus's death in 192 AD, the Senate's choice of emperor, Pertinax, was murdered by the Praetorian Guard, as described in the introduction to this episode, who then attempted to auction the empire to the highest bidder. But this time, as in the year of the four emperors, there was civil war. The Danube legions, led by Septimius Severus, revolted and overthrew the Praetorians and seized power. Having replaced the Italian Praetorians with his own men, Septimius then turned on his military rivals for the throne, defeating one who had been proclaimed emperor by the Syrian legions near Nicaea in modern Turkey, before bringing down the other main pretender in the west at a battle at Lugdunum in Gaul. Septimius was now the undisputed master of the Roman Empire. Septimius's accession marked a turning point in Roman government. At long last, the secret of the empire was recognized. His priority was the army and not the Senate. He established a new dynasty, the Severans, which ruled Rome with considerably more monarchical despotism than previously. He was the first emperor to reduce the city of Rome's power and influence by replacing the Italian Praetorian Guard with his own Danubian legionaries and to admit to the Senate more Easterners and Africans than Italians. So that he could keep firm control of the army and stop it from raising rebellions, he spent most of his reign on campaign, pursuing a vigorous military policy, sacking Parthian Ctesiphon in the east and embarking on an invasion of Scotland to crush the Caledonians who had overrun most of northern England. He also campaigned along the Rhine and North African frontiers. Indeed, to improve his popularity with the army, he removed the ban on marriage, which was widely disregarded anyway, and greatly increased army pay, raising the legionary annual pay from 300 to 500 denarii. Septimius's reign marked the beginning of the end of the Augustan constitution, for he no longer pretended, as the previous emperors since Augustus had done, that the Senate ruled the empire. On his death, his alleged advice to his sons was to enrich the soldiers and scorn all others. Severus's son Caracalla continued his father's policy of promoting the army above all else, increasing army pay this time to 900 denarii a year. Caracalla is probably best known for the remains of his enormous bath complex, much of which still stands in modern Rome, but his most important contribution to Roman history was the Constitutio Antoniana, or Antonine Constitution, in 212 AD, in which he conferred Roman citizenship upon all the free male inhabitants of the empire. This was yet another major change that further undermined the city of Rome's power and domination of the empire. But the longer-term effect was good, for it accelerated the internationalization of the empire and reduced its Italocentricity. This would in turn become one of the main platforms upon which the Roman Revolution of the 3rd century was built. But we will come to that later. So in the short term, the extension of citizenship was a response to a growing problem. The government was simply short of money. Caracalla's rationale was almost certainly to increase tax revenues by making a much greater number of people subject to inheritance tax, to which all Roman citizens were subject. And this raised yet another critical issue that would dominate Rome for the next 100 years, for the empire was running out of money. Why was that happening? The answer is probably due to a fundamental change in the economics of the empire over the period of the Pax Romana. Back in the days of Julius Caesar and Augustus, the empire's expansion had brought considerable wealth into Rome from conquered territories. For example, the Colosseum had been built in the 70s AD with the huge wealth seized by Vespasian from the sack of Jerusalem. But in the 2nd century AD, there were no more conquests other than the relatively poor Dacia. The flow of captured gold into Rome ceased. Indeed, gold started to flow out of Rome as the government paid the huge army guarding the frontiers. Rome had been a net recipient of wealth. Now it had an empire to maintain. Another crucial factor in the 2nd century, which undoubtedly hurt the economy, was the Antonine Plague. Add to that modern research suggesting that there was also an adverse effect from climate change, and it can be seen that the whole economic landscape was turning hostile. And we'll look at both of these in much more detail in later episodes. But the biggest change of all, which happened in the 3rd century, was the growing power of Rome's enemies. This began to put increasing pressure on the army, and it was this catalyst that would truly expose the frailty of Rome's political system. The downward spiral began in 235 AD when the Severan dynasty was abruptly curtailed by the brutal murder of the last Severan emperor, Severus Alexander. Severus was rounded on by his own soldiers in Mainz in Germany, apparently for his incompetence in confronting the growing power of a new German tribe called the Alemanni. The legion, called the Legio 22nd Primogenia, executed both him and his mother and proclaimed as emperor one of their own, Gaius Maximinus. The next 50 years would witness a carnage of civil war caused by army rebellions. Between 235 and 285 AD, there would be no less than 26 emperors proclaimed by the legions, an average of one every 2 years. If other military rebellions are included, the total number of insurrections is almost beyond counting. For example, one third century emperor, Gallienus, had to suppress no fewer than 18 of them. Why was the army so rebellious? The reason was that it was collapsing. For the first time, it was no longer strong enough to defend the frontiers. The barbarians were not just at the gates, they were beating them down. And that ends this episode. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, I'd be really grateful if you wanted to subscribe, tell a friend, or best of all, to leave a review. That would be fantastic. Thank you so much. And in the next episode, we'll look at the growing power of Rome's enemies, starting with the Persians. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.